Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading and rating. If you are someone who listens to the show regularly, let people know about it. Maybe you might inspire them to listen to the program or do science or just be more curious about the world. That's what this show is about. On this week's episode, we're going to be speaking to the brilliant Professor Jim Al-Khalili, physicist and author, about time. And actually, one of my favorite episodes of this podcast was with Carlo Rovelli about the nature of time, which we're going to be speaking to Jim a bit about. If you haven't heard it and you're willing to wait, it'll be in Future Proof's Gold on Thursday in the podcast feed. Really, really interesting piece. But we're going to be speaking to Jim this week. If you would like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We get to all of those comments at the end of the pod. First, though, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. And this week is a pretty interesting one. We're joined by Dr. Ruth Freeman, Director of Research for Society with Research Ireland, and Matthew Campbell, Professor of Genetics at Trinity College Dublin. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Ruth, has to do with dark matter, which listeners to the program will remember I am pretty skeptical about. I don't believe in dark matter, despite the scientific...
Yeah, I know.
Everybody knows this, right? But this is a story that claims to have potentially found a particle of it.
Yeah, well, that's what they say. So this is research that was presented at a conference in Japan this week. So important to say it's not yet been published or through the peer review process. Mm-hmm. And it's from a very large group of researchers, around 250 scientists and engineers from 39 institutions across the world. Everyone wants a piece of this. And it's a project that's been run by the US Department of Energy's Lawrence Berkeley Lab. And the site of the experiment is in South Dakota. But as you say, it is about dark matter. And, you know, dark matter is something that has mass out in the universe that we cannot see.
Allegedly.
That's what you always say.
Yes, please.
Allegedly. But I mean, when researchers look out into the universe, what they see is, you know, that stars that are at the outside of galaxies, which are spinning very fast, should be sort of spinning off into space, but they're not. There seems to be something with mass that is gravity is acting on, but it's something that we can't see. But it's been estimated that 85% of all of the mass in our universe is dark matter.
Which is crazy that we can't see 85% of the mass of all of the things that are in our universe, right?
Exactly. So this experiment is about, can we identify dark matter? And the experiment is called the Lux Zeppelin. And it's essentially a large waiting room that is sitting a mile underground in South Dakota, hoping that a dark matter particle will wander in and we can detect it. So it's a huge tank full of xenon. And xenon is an inert gas. It's as a liquid. And imagine it's a tank containing this enormous millions of xenon atoms, all packed in there together, fully purified. So they've purified this. It's underground to shield it. It's a mile underground to shield it from all sorts of cosmic rays, other kinds of radioactivity and particles. There's detectors.
Angry neutrinos.
Oh, angry neutrinos, exactly. It's surrounded by tanks of ultra pure water and detectors that could detect anything coming in that could influence the experiment. And it's an incredible experiment.
Like, I'm laughing because they were just waiting.
They're just sitting waiting. And they were waiting for, well, actually not that long. I was surprised. So the experiment went live in March 2023, and it was due to be live for 220 days. And what they found was they got one datum, so one point of evidence where they got a signal which seemed to suggest that one xenon nucleus had been moved by something. And they could not detect any particles entering the tank. They couldn't detect any other movement. And in fact, the signature of what they call the nuclear rebound, so it was knocked, essentially imagine like a tank of balls, and one of them just moved a tiny bit, but they can't detect anything that caused that movement to happen. So it was on the 16th of June in 2023, they picked this up. And what happens when a xenon nucleus gets knocked is there's two little flashes of light. So one, a little bit of energy is released from the movement and they could detect that. But then it would also knock a few electrons free and there's a charge inside the tank. So those electrons then move up to the top of the tank and they can see the difference in timing between the two flashes tells you where is the nucleus that was moved. And it's deep inside the tank. So it's not at the edge of the tank, which would potentially make it less interesting a result. So what did they do when they got this? It was one data point. I mean, they one of the descriptions is it's like having a room in the middle of nowhere that's completely soundproof with a studio level microphone in the room, and the outside is surrounded by microphones, and it's just there for hundreds of days. And then one day you just hear click in the room, but there's no sound outside. There's no sound coming from anywhere else. What caused the click? And that's kind of what they've been doing.
Yeah.
So they've been monitoring all of the data points over months and months, and they're trying to rule out all of the things that could possibly have caused this xenon nucleus. Somebody flushed the toilet upstairs.
Children going where they shouldn't be going.
But as you say, like a stray neutrino, you know, the ghost particles that come from the sun, that's the reason why they did it at depth, to try and filter out as much of that as possible. But nothing in the signal really matches what they expect to see. If it was a neutron, if it was a neutrino, if it was radioactive decay in the xenon, and again, they picked it because it doesn't really have radioactive isotopes. So it's all the signals are consistent with dark matter, but they have not seen a dark matter particle, and they're not claiming that they have.
Nor do we know what sort of energy a dark matter particle would give off.
Well, the energy, the amount, the kick that the nucleus got was bigger than they expected. And one of the things, they think dark matter might be made up of these particles called WIMPs. So, you know, the idea, and this doesn't exactly match what they thought a WIMP might be. These are weakly interacting massive particles. So they've given it a confidence score, I think, of 2.6 out of 5, 2.6 sigma. 5 sigma would be certainty.
Right.
So they're still quite far away.
You
can keep
2.5 sounds like it's half to 5.
But it's not.
It really isn't.
It's not.
And,
stay skeptical if you want.
With great claims require great evidence and so on. Yeah. Our second story, Matt, has to do with AI.
Yep, this is something that definitely does exist, and we know it does exist because it's impacting all our lives. And this has come from the European Society of Cardiology meeting that was on in Munich only last week. And it was funded by the British Heart Foundation, which is a charity in the UK. And it focused on electrocardiograms, ECGs, sometimes known as EKGs as well. These are, people will have had these ECGs before, and they measure electric activity in the heart. So you have these 12 leads attached to your chest, to your arms, your legs. Hmm. And they're really, really good at measuring electroactivity, the rate, the rhythm of your heart. But what they can't do is they're not very good at detecting heart disease. So they can't detect small blockages, you know, subtle changes in that are predisposing to heart disease. They're really not good at looking at changes in the valves either as well. You really need echocardiograms, which are much more involved. Mm. So that then leads to waiting lists, as we're hearing about all the time now with the HSE in Ireland, that, you know, once a potential defect is detected, people are put on a waiting list. It maybe lasts for months to have an angiogram or to have an echogram. So what this study did was it used artificial intelligence to try to predict changes in an ECG or an EKG that might relate to aberrancies in the heart, differences in the valves or blockages in the arteries.
Yeah.
It involved 67,000 participants in the US. And amazingly, this technology, this AI tool, was able to identify 81% of those individuals who had heart failure diagnosed. They could identify 90% of those individuals that had changes in the valves of the heart that open and close and allow blood into and out of the heart. So this isn't a complete...
With what sort of confidence? Because that is the key thing, right? If you can identify 81% of people who went on to have heart disease, that's great. But what about the other 19% that it doesn't diagnose? And of course, we know with the cervical cancer screening program, you know, you need really high confidence that you're saying this is not a false positive or false negative.
That's a brilliant point, and something to really reinforce that AI is not going to replace medical doctors. It's not going to replace cardiologists. It's not going to replace radiologists. We constantly hear this, you know, in the press that there's some disciplines of medicine will not be needed in the next 10, 15 years because of AI. This is not foolproof. It is potentially being sold now or thought about as a clinical tool to assist decision making in the clinical paradigm. So when patients come, what are the chances that they are going to have heart defects or valve defects?
Yeah.
This AI tool, it's a bit better. They're calling it a superhuman.
Yeah.
So it's better than humans.
But I mean, the speed at which it's able to do this is remarkable. The accuracy that it is, I mean, even just in present day, which is fantastic because we know these technologies will get better. But if it can even detect 50% of those cases with a 99% confidence, that is massively helpful. But if it can predict 81% with a 40% confidence, it's completely useless.
Exactly.
And so it's really, really important to understand, you know, whether or not it can really determine this is definite. Because once you can do that, you can reduce enormous amount of wait times, which is the key.
What it's going to lead to is a really, really strong triaging of people who need to be escalated for further studies.
Fantastic. Our third story has to do with something else artificial, which I've always been suspicious of. I mean, I'm super suspicious of AI, right? But sweeteners.
Yeah, well, I share your suspicion. And again, I'm not sure this story is going to be the conclusive evidence on it. But yeah, we all know all these different artificial sweeteners. The idea was sort of a free pass. You could make something taste really sweet and then you could eat these things without calories, without taking in sugar and building up glucose tolerance, etc.
Nothing for free in this world.
And actually, in 2023, the World Health Organization said there was no evidence that eating artificial sweeteners helped control body weight or indeed reduced your risk of diseases like diabetes. So they don't seem to have worked anyway. And the reason why they could be problematic, they were always sort of sold as just inert, you know, eat them, pass through you, go out the other side. But now there is research suggesting they are interacting with our bodies. They might be impacting how we taste sweet things, how our gut responds to sweet things, how we metabolize glucose, and particularly the gut microbiome. And I suppose that's really the focus of this paper, all the bacteria in our gut. And of course, the reason why that's important is one of the things our gut microbiome does, the bugs down there, they produce things called short-chain fatty acids. And these short-chain fatty acids help to strengthen the barrier of our gut, keeping it sort of protected from harmful bacteria, but they also help to control inflammation and they're involved in immune regulation in the gut. Now, the experiment is a small experiment. It was done in Chile and it was published in Frontiers in Nutrition. And the researchers took 47 male and female mice and they split them into three groups. And for 16 weeks, each of the groups got water with sucralose or water with stevia. And stevia is a sort of sweetener from a plant. But then they took those mice groups and they bred them to create a second and a third generation of mice. And the second and third generation only drank water. But then the researchers essentially measured a whole load of different tests on all three generations. So they looked at glucose tolerance, they looked at the gut, et cetera, et cetera. And they followed each generation for 20 weeks. So what did they find? They found that there wasn't much effect on blood sugar in the parent mice, but there were mild changes in the male children and grandchildren who ate sucralose. There wasn't really any changes with the stevia group. When it came to gut bacteria, the result was interesting. They actually found in all of the groups there was an increase in variation in the gut bacteria, particularly in the parents and the first generation. And it wasn't all bad. You know, there was some good beneficial bacteria. But what they found that both sweeteners reduced the number of these short-chain fatty acids that were produced in the gut. And those lower levels continued into the generations, even those that had never been exposed to the sweeteners. They also looked at gene activity. They found an increase in the activity of two genes linked to inflammation, both in the parents and
activity doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, these were small groups.
This isn't exactly a killer blow for artificial sweeteners.
It definitely doesn't
make you think about what exactly the effect of an artificial sweetener has on the human body.
Yeah, and again, like there was a gene involved in liver metabolism and they found that again, particularly with sucralose, definitely seemed to have the stronger effect. But I mean, we're talking about groups of six mice. And they're mice, they're not humans. So I agree, this definitely isn't the killer blow for artificial sweeteners. But, you know, possibly it is another link to say, you know, we probably should not just consider these things totally inert.
Yeah.
They may well be doing something and that seems like a reasonable hypothesis.
Our final story, Matt, is possibly a fantastic story for my dad.
Wow. Okay, so I assume that your dad has obstructive sleep apnea.
No, his wife does.
Oh, his wife does. There you go. That's what I was about to start by saying. If you've ever shared a room with somebody who snores, you know how annoying it can be because it impacts the sleeping patterns of both the people in the room. But some people have snoring that's so severe, it's actually caused by sleep apnea. And what obstructive sleep apnea, or OSA, is where the throat and the tongue, they relax too much during phases of sleep that they can actually close the airway. And it turns out breathing is pretty important. So what we treat patients with at the moment is what's called a CPAP device. We've got a mask placed in the face. It's called continuous positive airway pressure. And what this CPAP device does is you've got to wear it all night. And
it looks like an elephant mask.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's pretty loud as well.
It is. So it's an awful thing to have to wear.
But it forces air to keep the airway open. So it's pretty important. You know, it kind of ensures that you don't fall into these phases of apnea where the throat can close. And when the throat closes, I mean, I say it in jest that, you know, breathing is important. But, you know, these phases where the individual is not breathing can predispose to heart attacks. They can predispose to strokes. Mm. So there's a multi-morbid things can happen when you have these phases of sleep apnea.
Because you're suffocated and then jolted out of that by your brain kind of snaps you out of it.
Exactly.
This happens over and over again, which is highly stressful.
All through the night. It's also known that 40 to 50% of patients actually stop using this device because it's quite intrusive and you've got to clean it every day. And, you know, it really takes over some people's lives.
Yeah.
So there's a huge attrition rate with the patients that they just drop out. So over the past couple of years, there's been a company in the US called ApneaMed that's been developing a combo of two drugs. One is called oxybutynin and the other is called atomoxetine. And what they are basically is they're drugs that control the muscles at the base of the mouth and the tongue. And they're able to make them contract a bit more. So they stop them relaxing as much. In a phase 3 trial of 646 adults, 44% of patients were shown to have breathing interruptions failing or falling during phases of sleep, which is really, really incredible just from this drug. There are side effects, and the side effects were things like dry mouth, nausea, insomnia, but there was a dropout rate of about 20% with this drug. So it's really, really interesting that the side effects are much more minimal than the CPAP device. So in February 2027, this will be put before the FDA for potential approval. So this could be game-changing for people with obstructive sleep apnea. So really exciting results.
Yeah, although insomnia as a side effect seems a little bit cruel. I mean, isn't it? Really interesting stuff. Matt and Ruth, thank you very much. I am mad for a time travel movie. Age of Tomorrow with Tom Cruise. Excellent film. I just watched Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die. Sam Rockwell. That was also very good, but not as good as Age of Tomorrow. Groundhog Day. I love an old time travel movie. And, you know, a lot of the time you think, oh, that could never happen. But actually, understanding time is an immense task. And that is why Jim Al-Khalili has written a book. He's a theoretical physicist, host of BBC's Life Scientific, of course. But he's written many books. This book is called On Time, in which he tries to take on this mammoth task of explaining time to us. He joins me now. Jim, great to have you back on. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Glad to be back on.
This is a meaty, not leafy topic, in fairness. And you didn't decide to kind of touch on a bit of it. You kind of went, here's everything. This is all of time. Did it take a lot of time to put together?
I mean, the puns and jokes just write themselves, really, for a subject like this. I have to say, I mean, the title of the book, On Time, is fantastic. I didn't come up with it, my publishers did, but it's a fantastic title. Mm. It took me a long time to write. I mean, it's something that it's a niche I've been wanting to scratch a long time. But so I really felt I needed to sort of really cover the topic as fully as I could, because the nature of time is... It's not like if I write a book about quantum mechanics or cosmology, you know, the reader will say, okay, Jim, you're the expert, explain this to me. But when it comes to the nature of time, I think everyone feels they are somehow invested in it. Everyone has a theory about whether time flows and so on. So I had to give the whole thing time according to physics, time according to our psychological perception. And it was a long journey, actually.
Yeah, there's lots of different things to think about. I mean, but one of the most fundamental ones, which I'm surprised you had to answer, is like, you know, is time real? Why would anyone think time wasn't real?
It's incredible. Going all the way back to the ancient Greeks, 2,500 years ago, there's been this argument about whether is time something we just invented? Is it just that thing that clocks measure? That gives us, you know, the interval between events, or helps us, get to somewhere on time. There we go, on time. But is it a real tangible thing? Even to this day, a lot of philosophers and physicists would argue that time itself is just an illusion.
That's what my wife would say. My wife would say that completely. My wife is better than me at everything, but one thing she does not do is arrive anywhere on time.
Well, there you go. Time, therefore, is an illusion for people who can't stick to time. But I argue from a perspective of physics, and certainly Einstein's theories of relativity, time is a real physical thing. It's part of the fabric of space-time, fabric of reality. And that means that time is something we, to some extent, can control. We can stretch, we can squeeze it, we can...
You can't say that. We can't do... It's not a thing we can touch. And it's not a thing. It's a dimension, surely.
It's a dimension.
It's a quality of something, like a
listen.
A property.
Said,
it can't be a thing.
You said you enjoyed time travel movies. Yeah. How about the movie Interstellar?
Loved it.
Matthew McConaughey goes and orbits around this black hole, and he knows for every hour that goes by for him around the black hole, 7 years go by on Earth.
Yeah.
That isn't science fiction. That is exactly what would happen. Gravity literally slows time down.
How does it do that? I mean, I know that's true, but at the same time,
well,
that can't
it's
be true.
Because Einstein says gravity isn't what Newton taught us, what we learned at school, this invisible force pulling things together. It's the shape of space-time. And so the stronger gravity is, the more time is warped, the more time is bent. We are actually, countries around the world are arguing about how we measure time precisely on the moon. because a clock on the moon runs faster than a clock on Earth simply because moon's gravity is less. Mm. It's crackers, but it's a real thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's something else that you kind of made me think about there, and that is the concept of now, which I spoke to Carlo Rovelli about his book about time. And he kind of introduced me to this idea, which I hadn't heard before. You kind of talk about in the book, that there's no such thing as now, that now doesn't exist. And that is a crazy idea, that everyone's now is completely personal to them. There's no now.
Yeah. And yet now is the only time we can experience. You know, we can't experience the future. It hasn't happened yet. The past is gone, so that's lost to us. Surely the present moment is the only bit of time that is real.
But when we're sitting where I am, I'm having a different now to Aidan because he is experiencing light and sound at a different time. And so now is a moment. It's a moment on a line, right?
It's not just that. It's not just about like time zones or how long it takes for light to travel from one point to another. If two people are passing each other close to the speed of light in rockets, they would see each other's clocks running slower. So how can one of them say, this is now? They won't see, if one of them sees two flashes of light simultaneously, the other will see those flashes of light delayed, you know, so one before the other.
Yeah.
So what does it mean to say now? There is no universal now. Time is relative.
I feel like rolling up a spliff. It feels like one of those conversations. I'm condoning that at all.
No, of course. But it's just one of those lovely, lovely subjects that it's, you know, once you get stuck into it, it's mind-blowing. It really is fascinating.
So let's talk a little bit about, I know if we were flipping through things. So if you read the book, this is the whole point. If you read the book, you'll get into the meat of it, right? We're flipping through these ideas. Mm. But when we think about the direction of time, we feel like it's sort of linear, right? That it goes in one direction. Is that necessarily the case?
Well, certainly our perception of time, it's so obvious it almost hardly needs stating. Of course, yesterday comes before tomorrow. You know, time can't reverse. And we know there's a direction to time because, you know, we grow older. You put a hot cup of coffee in the freezer, it's going to get colder. The reverse doesn't happen. Balls roll downhill, not uphill. Batteries run out. So everything around us in the world looks like it's suggesting that time is pointing in one direction. But you get to the fundamental laws of physics and the equations of physics, and they suggest time can run forwards or backwards. Time is symmetric. And this has been a bugbear of physicists and philosophers for a couple of centuries now. How is it that our fundamental laws, which we believe that seem to work, say time is symmetric but run both ways, yet we never see time running backwards? Mm. So that's the meatiest topic that I address in the book, that there has to be an arrow of time. And the fundamental laws of physics are, in fact, just idealizations. They only work in certain situations. A lot of physicists won't like me saying that, but I believe I make a strong case for why they've been thinking about things the wrong way around. Time does have a direction. We're not kidding ourselves. It really does point from the past towards the future, never the other way around.
Right. Okay, so you're saying that this isn't just a fluke that we haven't experienced. It actually is fixed that way.
It has you fixed that. I mean, if you ask a physicist, why does time point in one direction? They'll say, it's the second law of thermodynamics. That's the fallback position for all physicists. The second law of thermodynamics says, this is the direction in which order becomes disorder. You take a pack of cards that's half shuffled, you mix it up, it's going to get more shuffled, not less shuffled. That's called an increase in entropy, second law of thermodynamics. And that gives us an arrow of time. I argue in the book that no, the arrow of time is more fundamental. It's baked into the universe from the start.
Building on that then, I mean, because the idea of tying together thermodynamics, essentially the transfer of heat and energy to time, seems like a ridiculous thing. Like time has nothing to do with heat. But actually, if we think about, you know, how we know time is passing, as you mentioned this in the book, how we know time is passing because we see things change. If everything froze still, so if we took everything in the universe and put it down to 0 degrees, you would stop time effectively, right? I mean, if everything in the universe was at 0 degrees and there was no energy in it whatsoever, then time would stop.
Well, I would argue, no, it doesn't. You see, I mean, I think Carlo Rovelli probably would disagree with me. And Carlo and I have had discussions about this a number of times in the past. I would argue time still continues to run. It's just that we would never be able to see, if there's no change, we can't appreciate time flowing by, time passing.
Mm. But it still happens, you think?
It still happens. So change needs time.
I like his idea.
Time doesn't need change.
I prefer his idea. You feel like it doesn't need, time doesn't need change. It will still continue. Even if you dropped everything to zero and there was no discernible movement, heat, or as physicists call it, work in the world, you would still see time. Time would still continue.
We wouldn't see it, but it would change. No. I mean, change needs time because to measure something changing. But for time to exist, it doesn't need change. A stone sitting on the ground not doing anything, time is still passing by outside of it. So the time is something that flows. It's almost going back to Newton's idea of an absolute clock, which Einstein essentially said is wrong. But I believe that time, because it's part of the fabric of reality, part of space-time, it exists. Even if there's no change in the universe, tough luck on the universe because you can't see time changing, time going by because there's no change. It doesn't mean there's no time.
If we think about the different properties we use to think about the world, right? You know, the standard model, which is this model that physicists have used to sort of create, figure out how all the universe fits in there, how, you know, how matter exists, how energy and forces work and so on. This idea of the standard model is kind of like the blueprint for the universe and all of its forces and stuff. Does time live in that? Or does it need
In the standard model or the equations, I mean, let's take one of the equations that describes, say, the behavior of the quantum world, Schrodinger's famous equation, his wave equation developed in the mid-1920s. Time comes into that equation, but it comes in just as what's called a coordinate, a parameter. It doesn't describe any change or flow. You know, you say, this is the state of what an atom is doing now. At this moment in time, T equals, you know, however many seconds after I started my timer. And I can use the equation to work out what that atom is doing 10 seconds in the future, what it was doing 10 seconds in the past. But at each moment, it's just a snapshot, a moment in time that tells us what the state of a system is. There's no flow of time in the equations of physics. And that's the same if you expand it out to the standard model of particle physics. There's no flow of time, but time is in there. As a parameter, as a coordinate, which is as distinct from time in Einstein's general theory of relativity, where it's a dimension. Mm. And that's one of the big challenges in physics. How do you reconcile time as a coordinate, as a number in an equation, with time as a dimension? And indeed, with time as an arrow in thermodynamics. So this is the big challenge. Different definitions of time from different areas of physics. But zoom out, and if you could have the God's eye view of sitting outside of the universe entirely, it may be that there is then no time existing for you. Time only exists within space-time, within the universe. But since we are always embedded in the universe,
well, if that's the case, then what about before the universe? What about before the Big Bang? Before the Big Bang?
Well, if you just follow standard Einstein's general theory of relativity, that would say the Big Bang was the moment of the creation of space and time. And so there was no before because there was no time to embed the word before in. It's a bit like me telling you, walk to the South Pole. And when you get to the South Pole, keep heading south. Meaningless, right? Because every step you take will take you back north again. So that's like the time down to the Big Bang. When you get there, keep going further back in time. You can't. The moment of the Big Bang is the moment that time moves out, moves forward. There is no before.
That's unsatisfactory to me.
It is unsatisfactory. And there are physicists are now even thinking about, well, maybe the Big Bang was just the beginning of our space-time, of our universe. Maybe there is a more general fundamental time existing. And the Big Bang was the birth of our bubble universe within a multiverse. But within the multiverse, time has been going on eternally.
It's Squirtles all the way down.
Who knows?
Last question, and it's the obvious one, right? We think about everything you've learned about time. You know, the physicists of the past have said that, you know, time travel is theoretically future. I'm not talking about like speeding things up with gravity. That's not, as you say, it's not the same thing. Traveling backwards in time or traveling forwards to a future point in time, where does the physics stand on that? Like from a physics point of view, is that just nonsense?
No, from a physics point of view, it is not ruled out. So Einstein's general theory of relativity allows for what are called closed time-like curves. The idea that you can warp space-time to the extent that it's a bit like on a roller coaster looping the loop. So you're going along, your time is moving forward, but you're looping back in time according to the outside world, and you arrive at a moment before you started. So closed time-like curves are solutions of Einstein's general theory of relativity. They would suggest that time travel into the past or the future is possible. The problem is, of course, it leads to all sorts of logical paradoxes. Mm. And so most physicists will say there must be a loophole that we have to close. There must be something in our laws of physics we haven't quite understood that would rule out time travel into the past, because these paradoxes are too crazy to entertain. But the math says it's still possible.
That may end up being a paper for a Nobel Prize, but it will also be quite a sad day if they close the loophole on time travel. Jim Al-Khalili is the author of On Time, The Physics That Makes the Universe Tick. Jim, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jim's great. I met Jim a couple of times at the Cheltenham Science Festival. When I did the FameLab thing. Do you remember I did the FameLab thing?
Yes.
Aidan McKelvey, producer, joins. Yeah, do you remember that?
What happened to FameLab?
Ireland ceased to be funded anymore by the British Council. The British Council had decided they wanted to go in a different direction. And so
they don't want to fund our scientists. They don't want to protect their airspace. Come on.
Well, the British Council now. The British Council are the...
I just mean the Brits in general.
The British Council do amazing work in Ireland. Not they just priorities changed and they were like, we're not going to fund this anymore. And that was that. And so there's no Irish FameLab anymore, which is a shame because it was a great competition.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was basically 3 minutes and you need to talk about your PhD or your work or any scientific idea for 3 minutes and you could bring props on stage. It was kind of a comedy thing. And lots of Irish people taking part. Irish people won it and everything went over to Cheltenham and this big stage. And it's a really big thing in the UK. And Jim Al-Khalili's been, you know, a judge on it or whatever. See, I met him a couple of times and went for a few pints with him. Funny, like actually all of the science communicator people from the British press are very, they're great fun. They drink a good drink.
Scientist pints.
Dara O'Brien, Jim Al-Khalili,
Dara Adam O'Brien Rutherford. Is a comedian as well.
Hannah Fry, they're all good fun.
Is a science pint different than a regular pint?
Yeah, it's better. It's way better than the sort of pints you'd ever have. I don't know.
That's a low bar.
I don't know what. In fairness, it is a bunch of clever people, but they're also good crack because most of them are broadcaster authors. They're good talkers. So, it's interesting because people, we do often talk about the talks or, an idea that someone had or someone's book. So it is flipping intellectual, I would tell you. Yes. But I don't go anymore now, so I feel like I'm, dumb.
Yeah. In it. You have to go for pints with people like me now.
Proper pints for people like you. So, comments from last week. We were talking, if you remember, about coffee. And there were some findings about coffee being anti-inflammatory and so on. Catherine from Wexford has got in touch. And she says, I think your comments regarding decaf coffee are not right. Because if you remember, we assumed that the study just was looking at just people who drank coffee. Because decaf coffee, you'd think, well, there's no caffeine in it, so why would you include that in the study? But Catherine says, I've read several papers going back 10 years that indicate many of the positive effects of coffee are independent of caffeine, e.g. anti-inflammatory. One reference, and she gives us a paper there, decaffeinated coffee and its benefits on health. So Catherine, we stand fully corrected and we love that.
Yes, absolutely.
Love that.
Because we kind of poo-pooed that question and we've been shown to be absolute fools ourselves.
Assumption makes a... Assume makes an ass out of you and me.
Indeed, and it did make an ass out of you and me. But in fairness to us, we did... I didn't
Don't
just...
in fairness to us. Like, you can't say in fairness to us. That's a ridiculous phrasing.
No, we shouldn't have poo-pooed the idea, but I did actually go back to the paper in question and see, and it was just that it never mentioned... decaf specifically. Yeah. So I made the assumption, but as we said, assuming is not always the best idea.
So we were talking about new species and insects in particular, and the fact that there are just gazillions of species of insects. And I just thought, and I made the ridiculous suggestion, and it was for just intellectual play, really. I was just saying that maybe We should just have less names and just group similar types of animals together. I still think that's such a brilliant idea.
Your theory was if we're a certain distance away and they look the same, they're all a donkey.
This is it. Like cow, donkey, horse, what's the difference?
Yeah.
Right? They're far, because just be, and I say that only because you'd get to know much more animals as a result. Obviously, and we said the distance would be relative, obviously, so it's an insect, you need to be closer. But essentially, like a horsefly, a blowfly, a firefly, all these sort of things. And I was saying, you know, like the differences need to be bigger to define a species than the differences that we currently say now, which is you can't mate. I think you also have to say it looks nothing like that. So like a crab and a lobster, come on, what's the difference?
Crabster.
I mean, what is the difference, really? A lot, of course, is the answer. But I guess what I was saying, it was a fight against the idea of overly complicated taxonomy, and that from a scientific, you know, point of view, it's very difficult to sort of almost take in these numbers and these multi named, slightly different animals, that it's hard to care about them when they're, you know, you're talking about one specific thing, but there's a billion other things that are just like it. General thing I was going for. Alex Smith, who was on the show talking to us about naming and categorizing these insects, says, just heard the podcast. I always hate it when they hear the podcast. I'm like, oh shit, this isn't going to be good. But Alex says, I heard the podcast. Thanks again for the chance to talk about these questions. I enjoyed the chat the two of you had afterwards. Jonathan mentioned children being too overwhelmed with a natural world that includes millions of new species differentiated by only tiny differences. I made that up, by the way. I'm not sure children are overwhelmed, but I was using a lot of creative play there. He says one reply to that might have been that Pokemon is pretty popular amongst kids, pretty much all adults actually, and they have a huge enthusiasm for this kind of thing. It just needs rewarding and encouragement. There are lots of Pokemon, his argument, that there's lots of Pokemon out there, all with different things, and people don't ever get tired of, you know, learning about Pokemon and so on. He says, thanks again, and look forward to a chance again about the little things that rule our world. I would say, yeah, but like all the Pokemon are quite different. Like if you had two Pokemon that were quite similar, you'd be like, nah.
But there is like a broader, like broadly speaking, I think a lot of, not everybody, but lots of kids, lots of adults have that sort of collection instinct. Like they want every sticker in the World Cup sticker thing. And they're all very broadly similar, but it's just a collection.
Yeah, but there aren't a million of those stickers. And well, each sticker don't look, you know, you have to look really close to tell the difference. Like I had the Italian 90 and you wouldn't be like looking at Andy Townsend and wondering, is that Paddy Bonner?
Is that Gianluca Vialli?
I don't know. I think the reason this all came up, right? It sounds ridiculous, but the reason it came up because Alex was saying it's hard to get people to care about things they don't have a name for and they don't understand. But you can't understand all of these insects, and so understanding sort of a category of insect might be more helpful, like a horsey, donkey, cowy type thing.
Stick insects, scorpions, they're all flies. Types of flies.
A scorpion is a type of fly?
No.
I see. Oh, you're making my... No, see, I wouldn't include those.
No.
But I would include horsefly, dragonfly, daddy long legs. You know, even though...
That's very broad.
I know. It's super broad. But there's too many animals and insects.
Let's...
Megafauna. You can leave megafauna alone. Right, megafauna, no problems. Or just general macrofauna, right? Anything you can see from like 20 meters away, you know, we'll leave that out. But like once you get really small, it's just hard to keep track.
Okay.
Prove me wrong. Prove me wrong, kids.
I think Alex did prove me wrong.
That's it from us on this week's episode of Future Proof. I'm Jonathan McRae. That's Aidan McKelvey who was producing. Rory Galvin was on podcasts. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.